You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. It's a cold night back in January 1983. When a Welsh farmer is surprised to discover that his fields are covered in a strange debris. However, things only get weirder from there. What happened on that farm over the next few days has become one of the most overlooked cases in modern British ufology. Thankfully, Mark Ollie returns to tell us exactly what happened and what was found as we discuss the contents of his new book, Europe's Roswell. 40 years since impact. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. All patrons, existing and anybody who signs up before New Year's Eve, will be entered into a draw to win a copy of Luke Phillips's marvellous Rogue, as discussed on last week's episode. So get signing up. Thank you to all my patrons for their continued and much valued support. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Don't forget to subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Our intro and outro music is provided by the incredible Weary Pines. A big thank you to Dean Bestel, as always, for his wonderful artwork. And the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, we head back to that cold night back in 1983, when a Welsh farm seemed to be the site of something deeply unusual. January 1983 and the off-season sleepiness of the coastal town of Aberystwyth and the small village of Clania was disturbed by something remarkable overnight. Did some off-world vehicle crash, or was it covert military tests? What covered the fields of the farmers in debris? Returning to shed a light on this often overlooked case is Mark Holley, whose new book, Europe's Roswell, 40 Years Since Impact, sheds information unavailable previously. Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be here. Nice to see you again.
Yep, always a pleasure, sir. Always a pleasure. As we were saying before we started, before we dive into this case, because it's one of those that when you read about it or you have studied the UFO field and read certain reports and watched every nonsensical documentary ever made probably in the last 30 years, Mark, which I'm not proud of, occasionally this case gets a very brief mention, usually in when they're doing an overview of numerous other probably more well-known Welsh cases.
Yeah, I
had to chuck them when I was reading the book, because I've seen this case try to be amalgamated into what happened at Berwyn.
Oh, don't get me started.
I've also seen it mentioned as an addition to Broadhaven,
right?
And I think sometimes it depends where in the world someone is when they're doing this. It's one of those where I think people, like on Blankety Blank the other week, somebody asked about name a part of England in the north and they put Wales.
I've even heard it mentioned in conjunction with Rendlesham, and it's got nothing to do with that.
No.
Nothing to do with it.
No, not at all. So for you, how did this fall into your lap? Because like you say, this is not the easiest case to unpick and cover, really, Mark, because it doesn't make sense how little information there seems to be about this. It's like nobody seems to really care.
Well, you've gone from the beginning to the end there. I mean, I'll answer both questions in a sense. I don't think anybody does care, because at the end of the day, if you actually, you know, turned up with a UFO parked on your back garden lawn and some little green bloke came out and went, "Hi, I'm from Venus," then that just blows the entire thing out of the water, doesn't it? Mm. Destroys the mythology, destroys the mystery. You know, there's some things I think the majority of people are better off they think they're better off not knowing. Mm. You know, they just kind of think, yeah, the chase is better than the catch. So I think there's a massive, massive element of that. Because we actually have something and we can, you know, produce it, then that is a bit of a turnoff, I think. So that's sort of the reason why I think it's gone that way, apart from the usual cover up, etc. But yeah, you were asking how I got involved in this. Well, I met Gary up in our neck of the woods. We had this conference called Probe that used to take place in Blackpool. Sam and Gene Wright used to run it years ago, and I was a speaker at Probe, and Gary was a speaker at Probe. And we ended up meeting up and having a chat and hung out with a curry afterwards, like you do. And Gary just kind of, he said to me, he said, "You're an archaeologist, aren't you?" And I went, "Yeah, I dig stuff up." He said, "I need to speak to you sort of off the record, get in contact, you know, when we finished up here," sort of thing. Which eventually we did, took a few months, got round to it. And Gary basically said, "Well, I might have a UFO that you can come and dig up." And I'm like, "Really? Really? Do I want to get involved with this as an archaeologist?" And then he went through the full story, which I'm sure we'll cover in a bit. And then he sort of got to the end of the story. And the punchline really of what he was saying was, and he says, and I've got a few pieces of crash debris in a case in my garage. Now, that for me, that's the clincher. Because I just generally, in everything I do, if anybody reads me books or watches the TV programs or the documentaries I've done or anything like that, I'm a sort of, if it quacks like a duck and it looks like a duck, then, you know, shoot, it's a duck. So that's my approach to things. Now, you know, Gary could have said, "Well, you know, we saw these flickering lights, or we saw these shadows, or, you know, we've got this weird bit of footage or this weird bit of photograph," and it just would not have interested me at all. But the fact that we had something physical, we also, I mean, I can tell you a little bit of the story as well, because Gary's interest came from a newspaper article. So we had that. There was an eyewitness. So we had that. So then we've got the debris, we've got a location, we've got a time. You've got enough there then to start to build a proper case. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, hey, I could write an archaeology report about this, you know. And then after that, it just got weirder, weirder and weirder from that point on. So where do you want to go with the story?
Well, there is something about this case that just surprises me, because there are elements that you can see that have appeared, especially in the UK, Mark. Lots of interesting things. We've got covert people. We've got the ability of authorities to mobilise large units of people to come and go as almost like ghosts.
Yeah.
You've got a gap in the kind of history of this that, I mean, this happened at the beginning of 1983, as I said in the introduction, in January.
Yeah. Yeah,
the coastal area, especially in Wales in winter, is not the best place to be.
No.
Which is remarkable. You had so many people get there in the dead of night to do what they needed to do. And I'm perplexed by how little interest there's been in this case over the years, especially in this country and especially in Wales, because Welsh UFO cases, especially over the last 5 years, seem to have really risen in their stock. We've had some very interesting cases come to light in the modern era. We've also had some kind of reflections and re-evaluations of everything that went on at Broadhaven, not just what happened at the school, but everything else that was going on around there.
Yeah.
And yet, nobody seems to have bothered with this, or they misidentify it, or they try and put it into a different case.
Yeah. I mean, even when we sent the results, when we sent off the pieces of metal for testing, the reason the introduction to the two reports that came back, one from Australia and one from America, the reason the introductions don't appear in the book is because that is precisely what they did. The background information that they somehow managed to cobble together from here, there and everywhere, it just mixed about four different cases together. Especially, much to my annoyance, the Berwyn Mountain one, which incidentally, for the record, is 1974. This one is 1983. You know, they are not the same. It's not the same incident, but they just mix them all up. You know, and, you know, it almost gets so silly that you end up thinking, you know, maybe somebody somewhere is actually putting some kind of disinformation out there. I mean, I mention it in the book, and I'm not going to say who it is on here, because I've kept it quiet, but there was a website that had basically the same story on it, and it finishes up with like a UFO disc sticking out of the woods with alien bodies hanging out of it. And I just read that and I thought, this is nonsense. It's, you know, disinformation. So clearly somebody somewhere was putting stuff out about it that was either not true or, like you say, covering it up, not putting any information at all out. So certainly this book's going to put the record straight. Certainly it will. You know, the information in the book is right. It's dead right.
When I was reading that particular section, and we'll talk about the lack of publicity about this particular case. What I've always found strange about certain things like this, I was recently re-listening to an interview Art Bell did with a councilwoman called Frances Barwood, who was the local councilwoman who ended up getting a load of pressure and harassment and ridicule back in 1997 when she had the audacity to ask in a council meeting about the strange lights that people had said they'd seen in the sky.
Yeah.
And within a week, she was pictured as being a tinfoil hat wearing lunatic in the local paper. They were misquoting her, saying she was talking about aliens and little green men and all that. And all she actually said was, because it was televised as well, so it's not like you can't
see it.
Yeah. You know exactly what she said. And she simply said, lots of people have reported these strange lights. I want to know, what is there any investigation? And within a week, she'd been made this pariah of idiocy that they all said, oh, look at this lunatic. Which, I mean, there was other things at play here. She was causing the mayor a lot of issues. Fife Symington's very happy to talk about the incident these days, but at the time he was there was a few strange things going on in that particular area of Arizona, shall we say? And things like planning permission being given to people who take him out for tea and things, which I'm sure is purely coincidental. But
well, of course.
These kind of things always strike me that's 25 years ago, and yet here we have a local member of the community, clearly well established, a farmer, who wakes up one morning doing the lambing, I think, or checking on his sheep overnight.
Yeah, checking on his lambs and his ewes,
Who suddenly comes across loads of debris. And then you think, well, when we look at certain cases, especially at that period of time, because as we were saying about the cases it gets lumped in with, Rendlesham had only just hit the headlines around the same period. So, you know, the appetite for these kind of particular stories, especially in the British tabloid press, Mark, was probably at a high point. They would have been scouring the country for other similar stories, I would imagine, due to the furore about what had allegedly happened at Rendlesham. So what happened? How did this case seem to just fizzle up like a shaken bottle of pop and then just dissipate completely? It's like it just, after January the 27th, 1983, it just went, gone. Nobody knew.
I'm going to be facetious. I'm going to say, well, the answer to that is it was a weather balloon. It was a weather balloon, don't you know?
Which actually nearby.
It's not as facetious as it sounds.
Cause yes.
Trust me, the parallels to Roswell are frightening, because you know you got Matt Brazel wandering out there picking up pieces from his ranch, and then you got Earl Evans walking out there picking up pieces from his, going, what the hell's all this? You know, so you've only really got one, you know, on the spot eyewitness that's independent, and it's the farmer. You know, as soon as the military get wind of it, you know, via whatever, police, whoever, as soon as the military get wind of it, they're in there, they're cleaning it all up, they're taking it all away. That's identical. That's exactly the same thing they did in Wales. They tried to take it all away, to the extent that where Gary and his team got in there a few weeks later, they pulled a few bits out from a local woods. There was a woods adjacent to the fields, and you could see where this thing about 20, 25 foot wide had gone through the tops of the trees, and obviously didn't, you know, the trees didn't agree with it and broke it all up. But there were a few pieces still in the woods, and that's where Gary got his bits from. A few weeks later, they're demolishing the woods. You know, that's being disposed of. So, you know, there's been a few teams gone into Roswell. None of them have really found anything. Maybe they've come up with a few, you know, bits and fragments and bits of melted metal and what have you. Well, you could argue Gary's in a slightly better position than that, but it's still only six bits at the end of the day. It's still only six fragments. So, you know, you've got that. Then you've got the newspaper report. Well, exactly the same as Roswell. On the day and the day after, newspaper reports come out. Next minute, wham, the whole lot's gone. It's denied. It's a weather balloon. It's finished. That's it. You know, well, the same thing happened with this Sunday Express report. That comes out and it just gets ignored. It just disappears. It vanishes into the woodwork. So it's just running parallel in so many ways to Roswell. I think the difference is the culture. You know, I think there's enough people around anywhere in the United States to be like, you know, hang on a minute, we've got a mystery here. Let's, you know, push a bit further into this. Mm. If you're in the middle of Wales, if you're at the end of a Welsh valley and it's January or February or whatever, and I mean, this came down outside the village of Clonilla. It's Clonilla's just the nearest inhabited settlement you can stick a pin in.
Yeah.
I mean, the crash at Roswell was at a place called Corona.
It wasn't
actually in Roswell itself. Well, you've got the same situation here. You know, it's about 2 miles up the valley where the crash site is. So, you know, it's just exactly the same thing. It's the same parallel thing happening all over again. There is actually, interestingly enough, the possibility that Matt Brazel held back a briefcase worth of material, and it's thought he might have hidden it in the house he was living at before he died.
Mm.
So there could even be that parallel that somewhere out there is the Roswell material waiting to be rediscovered. And we've got it. We've got material here as well in a case. But it's just been, it's been treated pretty much the same way in terms of a cover-up. I suppose you either, you know, deny it, rubbish it, or ignore it. And in a way, we were lucky because we got the third one. We basically got ignored. You know, which I'm quite happy to live with under the circumstances. We're still here. That's the main thing. We're still here.
Yes.
It hasn't gone away.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it's quite surprising, I think, like we were saying, because we've got this chap, Irwell,
who basically
was saying he had large pieces of debris scattered all over the place. This was not... like on occasions you'll be walking down the road and you'll find a mysterious hubcap from some car
past. When people have spoken to him, he said he actually thought that an aeroplane had crashed. That's how much debris. You're talking four fields. Anyone that doesn't know Wales very well will probably just think of, you know, a standard field. They're not. They're massive.
Yeah.
These fields are really big.
Mm.
You know, so much so, we filmed them actually for the documentary we did in 2008. And people have said, you know, oh, why didn't you put the fields in the documentary? Well, we did. I think it's the second or third shot. There's a panning shot. And it's, you know, white fog on a white sky, you know, with white fields covered in snow with white sheep in. So you could be forgiven for wondering what the hell it is. But we actually do pan across the fields. They don't make good camera material. But they're huge. Absolutely enormous, you know.
And Irwell's one of these chaps, as most farmers would be, Mark. They seem to have a photographic memory when it comes to their livestock and their areas and their fields. They know exactly how it is.
Yeah.
It's implausible to presume that this had been there for more than a few hours because, as he said, he went out the evening before, nothing. He came out, crack of dawn. And there's this debris everywhere. So did Irwell contact the authorities after finding this? Because, as you say, he suspected that a plane had come down, which you would, first thing you would do, you clearly phone the emergency services.
Well, yeah. He's got these big sheets of metal. Some of them are, you know, 6 foot, 2 meters square. He's got that all over the place. He said there was other bits of debris in there. I mean, in the newspaper report, it's interesting because it mentions a girder with some code numbers on and an aerial. And when I spoke to Irwell, he said, no, it didn't come from me. He said, I don't remember things like that. He said, but I do remember a lot of bits, you know, bits of stuff that he couldn't identify. He assumed it was a plane crash, so he phoned the local police. The local police hadn't heard anything, obviously. So they were the ones then that contacted the MOD, because there is MOD in that area. There is an airbase or whatever. And then next minute, he gets all this, you know, military stuff kind of turning up, you know, clean up team and all the rest of it. And then there's a third set of people, these people in non-uniformed, he described them, suits, basically, called them suits, who are ordering everybody else around. So, you know, important police sergeants and, you know, colonels and whatever else that are there from the Air Force. These guys in the suits are ordering them around. And that basically went on for the best part of that day. And as far as Irwell knows, most of the night as well. Because eventually, of course, he still has to, you know, look after his livestock and everything. So he said it was about midnight. They were still going at it. He said it looked like a scene from a James Bond movie, you know, floodlights everywhere and, you know, people going across his fields, clearing them. So he just left them to it. And by the time he got up the following day, he assumed that everything had gone. You know, he thought it had all gone. And then about 2 weeks later, the newspaper article came out and he was contacted by Gary. And he said, well, yeah, you're welcome to come down and have a look, but I think they've cleared it all away. And Gary's like, no, they won't have got all of it. Absolutely no way. And sure enough, they hadn't. They hadn't got all of it.
Mm. I mean, you only have to look at Irwell for a prime example, because often when we have cases like this, Mark, one of the easiest ways people will try and discredit them is say, oh well, they were just looking for publicity. They were clearly into ufology. They were desperate to make as much money as possible. And yet here we have a guy who his behavior after this event clearly shows that wasn't the case. His lack of real interest, I mean, at the end of the day, it's priorities. It's winter. He's got a job to do. He's not going to be staying up all night ferreting about, seeing, oh, I wonder what's going on here. He just thought, right, well, I'll let them get on with it, and I'll speak to her in the morning. I've got my livestock to look after, and the farm needs to be sorted.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that credibility stayed with him as well, because he didn't want the farm identifying. He didn't want that on camera. He didn't want the location giving away or any of that sort of information. He wasn't really interested in being interviewed in 2008 when we were doing the documentary. He just said, well, I've not got anything else to say. You know, just that's it. It is what it is. So we just didn't, you know, it wouldn't really be fair to sort of, you know, he's kind of incidental. He's the, you know, unwitting witness of something. So it's not really fair to put him in the spotlight. So both me and Gary have always sort of, you know, been very respectful towards Irwell, and he's no spring chicken now. He's older. I mean, it's 40 years since the crash, you know, and he was probably 20s going on 30s when the crash happened. So, you know, he's still doesn't want to, you know, dive into the fray. And the same thing's true of Gary. You know, Gary's like, I think he says it in the introduction to the book. He said, you know, he could have made a movie out of this. He could have had it all over the press. You know, could have made a fortune. Best UFO story in Britain. You know, it's like Roswell. It's all around. But he's never done it. He's just never done it. He's not, you know, he's an investigator. He's a professional, and he's not interested in sensationalizing anything. And lo and behold, it falls to me. I'm an archaeologist. What have I got to gain from this? You know what I mean? I'm not going to become a multimillionaire from this. It's never going to happen. So, you know, the whole thing is just, it's a group of people who are fundamentally interested in getting the story out there, you know, and the material out there, and just saying, you know, hey, what is it? You know, what the hell is this? Because we're all investigators, you know. Irwell does have curiosity. You know, he would very dearly love to know what the hell it was. Gary certainly would, and the rest of Gary's team, you know, so I guess we're sort of, you know, reaching out for closure in that sense. But the analysis didn't help. We'll come to that in a bit. Oh, that really didn't help. We thought it was going to close everything up nicely, but it didn't.
Yeah, it's often the case. Often the case, Mark. I mean, there are thousands of cases where a witness sees something, come across as something, experiences something, and it changes their life. I'm quite taken aback by how, as you say, he's got curiosity, but he's generally very disinterested about this, because you could see sometimes these kind of incidents put people on a path, completely changes their life, and the next thing we know, they're running around the world trying to find answers to whatever. And I think Irwell was probably, because of his lack of knowledge about the subject of ufology, Mark, I think he didn't think it was anything out of the ordinary until he got up the following morning and everybody'd gone.
Yeah, that's really one of the strengths, one of the real strengths of Irwell. He's solid, he's down to earth, he's a proper Welsh farmer. I'm pretty sure he's a Welsh speaker. I'm pretty sure I heard him speaking Welsh at one point. So a proper local. And from his point of view, something physical, very physical, came down. He's a bit like me in the sort of, you know, shoot, it's a duck kind of category. Clearly, it would appear that whatever it was something connected to the military, because they seemed to know where it was and they cleaned it up. So it's gone somewhere, you know, it's gone into their military system or whatever. It's, you know, in boxes or stuck in a hangar somewhere or whatever. And I think that's where Irwell was. I think, you know, with the police and the army and these other guys there, he was like, right, that's it, okay, that's took care of it, you know, as long as it doesn't affect me and me sheep and everything else, that's it, just, you know. And he's very down to earth. He's a very down to earth character. He doesn't appear a great deal, I'll be honest. He's not in the documentary from 2008, although his testimony is. He didn't have anything else really to add then, so I didn't go out of my way to disturb him again for the book. You know, I think, like you say, he is what he is. He's just a good, solid eyewitness to what the rest of us would have thought was, you know, fairly strange. But, you know, now it's queer as folk, as they say. You know, there we go.
Absolutely. Yes. And so, 2 weeks, well, it's about 2 weeks later, isn't it? This article appears in the Sunday Express. Nobody seems to know who the source of this story is, Mark, which is always a red flag for me, because Irwell says, well, I didn't speak to them.
Yeah. Well, so, actually, can I pick you up on that? Because it's brilliant. When we did the documentary in 2008, I was in contact with a chap who's now working in the National Library of Wales. He's another archaeologist, very highly regarded academic, and this was Scott Lloyd. Mm. So I thought, right, I'm going to bring him in because, you know, not only does he know where to go in Wales to get information, you know, he's the man to do the job. So he basically, like yourself, took one look at the article and went, oh, yeah, let's contact the guy that wrote this. You know, let's get out there and see if we can find out where it came from, which is the obvious thing to do. So, you know, he gets on the blower to Andrew Chapman at the Sunday Express. And Andrew's like, well, do you know, by sheer coincidence, I'm one of these journalists that keep all my notebooks. He said, so leave it with me and I'll go and have a look and I'll see where this thing came from. Now, Andrew, the best that we could work out from the conversation with Andrew when he came back to us, he said, it looks like I was handed this story when we came back after the New Year break. So that you're talking, I don't know, certainly after the 3rd or 4th of January. So that first week of Jan, he's handed the story and he said, and that, you know, there's no notes as to where it came from. Because back then, the runners with the stories, you know, in the press would just come around the office and hand out the files for people to write up. And that's really the level that this has come on. You know, it's come from that kind of, you know, so he has no idea. There's no note in his diary at all. He remembers the story. He remembers doing it. He remembers, you know, being handed it to write up. He has no idea. And like I say, some of the details are different from the ones that Irwell remembers, which actually I think gives it credibility. You know, all the dots don't join up. It's not like 100% the same right across the board. There are differences, and I've allowed those differences to remain in the book. I don't think they're contradictions. I just think they're differences. And they're important because, you know, for me as an archaeologist, if everything was the same, it would certainly look like somebody was, you know, spinning a yarn. But yeah, it doesn't come from Irwell because he didn't really speak to anybody other than Gary. Gary definitely didn't do anything with it because Gary only got involved when the article was already released.
Yeah.
And when we did the search, when we contacted Andrew, there aren't any other articles. That's it. There's only that one.
Which for me is one of the most striking parts of all this early aspect of it, Mark, because why did someone choose that paper? Why did it only go there? Because I find it hard to believe that this didn't go to several, if it was passed around in such a manner. Why did nobody else publish it? Why were there no local press really, really interested in it? Why is nobody, because especially on the old days, the wires, they would all pick up stories. You would have stories being passed from paper to paper just to fill a bit of space up.
I mean, possibly on a local level, it might be because they got away with it. You know, whatever it was that came down, whatever hit those trees, it did it at night. It was sufficiently far away from civilization for nobody to notice. There were no witnesses to it actually coming down. You know, nobody heard it. There was none of that. So maybe on a local level, they just didn't want to make a song and dance about it. Anybody that knows anything about the valleys around, you know, Aberystwyth and coming up into North Wales, there is a UFO triangle there. You know, stuff's coming out of Cardigan Bay all the time. You've got books like the Denbigh Lights. You know, there's books coming out for South Wales as well at the South Wales Triangles. You know, Gary's had encounters there. That's why he had the UFO group there. I've seen stuff up in the Mersey Valley, which is the top edge of the triangle. So, you know, people don't want to be living in fear of something coming down and, you know, hitting the top of the house. So I think that was possibly the reason why the locals, you know, didn't pick up on it. Mm. They just didn't want to start a panic.
Mm. I suspect as well, you've often got situations where, as we mentioned earlier, you know, there were two very notable UFO cases that had happened in Wales prior to this, which is Broadhaven and Berwyn. Do you think that might have had something to do with why nobody was very willing to put themselves out there or to speak even more about it because they'd seen what had happened? I mean, some of the excuses given, especially Broadhaven, you know, what was it supposed to be? It was a council recycling van that they claimed. Berwyn was dismissed as poachers. I mean,
well, heard different things about Berwyn. Yes. My own personal feelings and from my own personal research, I think Berwyn, but there were people lost on the mountain. And the rescue folks went out to try and find them. And that was the first set of lights that people saw. And the next set of lights that people see then is, you know, either fire or ambulance, whichever of the two went up. And there was a helicopter involved as well in that recovery. And then it just ballooned. It ballooned from there because the atmospheric conditions made it look bigger than it was, made the mountain light up, you know, low mist, low cloud and all that. So I'm not saying that the folks that, you know, were witnesses and saw all that didn't see something. Yes, they absolutely did, but not a UFO. And when you bear that in mind, I mean, that piece of information would have gone around locally. And like you say, the locals are not going to want a repeat of something similar happening again, you know.
Yes, yeah, because there are. It seems to have been one of those stories that, how it's very similar to several other UK cases, the story we see now and hear about now doesn't really match a lot of what happened at the time.
No.
But hey, that's the internet and unscrupulous people for you.
As I said, one person tried to get it, the ship that actually flew away, leaving all this debris. They had it nosedived into the ground somewhere in the woods with bodies hanging out of it, which actually is a sort of a push together from a Russian incident. That incident actually happened in Russia, and they'd confused the two and pushed the two together. So, you know, oh dearie me.
So obviously, Gary, as we were saying, we've got this article that's appeared from nowhere. Nobody seems to know where it came from. Nobody knows why it only appeared in one particular publication. Gary sees this because I think he gets it sent by these wonderful old
news clipping cutters. Service. Yeah, the news clipping service. I don't think that exists anymore. But yeah, if you had a particular interest, you could register for clippings and stuff. And they sent him this one.
Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. It takes me back when I first started reading the Fortean Times and there were official clippers for the Fortean Times and things. And you think, oh, little things like that. Sometimes we forget about them. But they were vitally important, especially when we're dealing with strange phenomena. And so Gary manages to get in touch with Irwell. Says, can I come down? And he says, yeah, of course you can. But as we've said, it was under the impression, well, unfortunately, you're a bit late.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Gary, he told us a very good story of leaning on this, you know, 5-bar gate, you know, him and Irwell staring out across the field and, you know, Irwell saying exactly that, you know, you've had it, mate. It's gone. You know, there's nothing here, which is, I mean, you know, obviously they did the fields, they covered the fields and you know, Irwell was right, it was all gone, but not the forest. You know, there's bits of metal stuck in trees, there's still a lot of debris floating around from the impact, you know, and then on ground level, there are bits, you know, sort of on the ground. So they got 6 pieces of the metal and they got 2 pieces of this strange looking tin foil out of the bracken and stuff. And what they wanted to do was go back with proper metal detecting equipment. And they went back a second time for a visual, didn't find anything. When they were going to go back with the metal detecting equipment, that's when Gary got the phone call off Irwell saying, you know, they're removing the woods, they're demolishing the woods. So clearly in the, you know, January going into February, somebody had tipped somebody off that, you know, there was other people poking around in there, fishing stuff out. And when Gary phoned up the Forestry Commission and said, what are you doing? They're like, well, it's wind damage. And Gary's like, well, do you normally get rid of an entire forest for wind damage? And the guy on the other end was like, no, but in this case we are. So it's great in the interview in 2008 when Gary's describing that. He said, I'm sure the fella at the other end of the phone was smiling when he said it. you know.
Well, that leads to two questions then, really, Mark.
Yeah.
Firstly, was this under surveillance and nobody was really aware of it? They were just making sure. And obviously, clearly somebody had to be, because how would a remote farm be people be able to know about what was going on up there? Because as you say, people were keeping to themselves. Mm. Irwell wasn't courting publicity at all. But also as well, and this may seem like a very obvious question that may or may not have been picked up on or anything, did anybody check the weather reports to validate what they were saying, to say, was there a storm that particular night, as if to give it some credence? Because usually, Mark, they'll try and blame, I don't know, some kind of virus, such as Dutch elm disease or birch disease that's causing it, that's the reason for it. But to say they're removing an entire wood because of a storm that's damaged a few trees seems ludicrous.
Well, I can't speak for Gary, but I'm sure Gary would have checked. And you don't tend to get tornadoes ripping through Welsh valleys in the middle of January. Well, beginning of January, you know, that's not a common occurrence. So, and then on the other point as well, you know, was somebody actually keeping an eye on what was going on? Very clearly somebody was keeping an eye on what was going on. The timing on getting rid of that forest is just, you know, it's beyond coincidence. And around about the same time as that's going on, you know, maybe give or take a week either way, Gary gets a visit, you know, gets a knock on the door and he opens it. It's two guys there dressed in black suits, black hats, dark glasses, passes that you can't really make head and the tail of. Gary glances up the close where he lives and there's a couple of black SUVs with the windows blacked out, no number plates. And these guys say, can we have our material back? Can we have our pieces of metal back, please? At which point Gary goes, no, you can't, because I've broken one of them up into loads of key rings and I've given them all out to people who've got contacts to the media. So as long as you leave me alone and you don't come back for my bits of metal, the rest of your material's safe. I'll tell them not to release it. But he said, if you come back knocking on my door again, it's going public. So apparently these guys just, you know, nodded and got back in the vehicles and drove off. But that obviously, you know, I've not said it in the book, but it does raise the question. They obviously knew that Gary had the material and they obviously knew where he lived. So, you know, but Gary's used to that. Gary will tell you that, you know, he, at that particular point, he was quite prominent as a speaker and as somebody involved in UFOs in North Wales. So it wouldn't have been too difficult for them to find out where he was, you know, especially if you're on the public speaking circuit. I mean, you actively advertise your existence, you know, so that wouldn't have been difficult. But the fact that they knew, you know, they'd researched, they'd found out he'd got these pieces and they tried to get them back, you know, that it does speak of being watched, and I think that site was probably watched. Although, you know, from my point of view, I only got involved in the about 2004, 2005. Nothing like that's ever happened since. Although Gary is extremely cagey about the material he's got, he doesn't keep it at home. He keeps it in a lockup, a secret location. He doesn't give his address away. And if the box ever comes out for display or for anything like that, he usually attaches it to his person so it can't be snatched. But he hasn't got all the pieces in there anyway. Three of the six pieces are on display in his box and the other three are stored safely away. So yeah, that aspect of it is most definitely there, you know.
Who did Gary go to when he got these pieces then, Mark? Where did he decide to take this from? Because I think the fact that he had the foresight to chip bits off, which he did, and create these keyrings, which are rather well made, you know, they clearly spent time. He was very wanted these to be presented in a very interesting manner. It looks an interesting piece. So
it's professionally done. It is. He's done a good job. I think fairly soon afterwards, I'm not sure if it's sort of the February or the March, but soon after everything we've just described had sort of died down, and Gary was then aware that obviously he had something of some significance within the realms of his UFO group. Within his own group were people who had connections to people in the aerospace industry. There's a couple of fellas that were involved in you know, aerospace. There were a couple of ladies that restored aircraft. There was another chap that had contacts with British Aerospace and what they were doing. So basically, he spent a bit of time sort of touting material around, trying to, you know, find out more about it. I mean, you know, the fact that you've physically got something does make you think that, you know, it's got to have come from somewhere. You know, this is here. You know, I'm looking at it. So, you know, off he goes, tries to find out what it is. He didn't get much results from most people. A couple of folks said that's not off any aircraft I've ever seen. A couple of folks said that's not aerodynamic. It's, you know, it's got resin on one side and it's got matte green paint on the other, so that wouldn't fly unless it's come from inside something. Eventually, it ended up with British Aerospace, who I've seen it. They did him a report, you know, hats off to his friends in the aerospace industry. They produced this report, which is about, I don't know, 12 pages long or whatever. And it does have some form of analysis. But to get them properly analysed at that point in time, you're talking £4,000, £5,000, £6,000. The budget wasn't there to do the full analysis. So they did the best they could. And they come back and they say, OK, it's an alloy and it looks like it's duralumin. Now, duralumin's been around since the First World War. They used to make airships out of it and stuff like that. But the thing with this is that they came back and they said, but it's a very pure alloy of duralumin. It's not like anything we've ever seen. And it would be great if we could work out how to make this. So even then, you know, you're talking the 1980s, 1990s, they'd got a handle on the fact that it was something advanced, but they didn't really quite know how advanced, because that comes out in the analysis. So, you know, hats off to Gary for trying to, you know, do the best he could with what he had. And he knew it was something exotic and a little bit strange. And I've got to say, still to this day, we've not had a definitive analysis come back on the grey resin, because there's grey resin on there, the green, the strange green paint coating that's on it. We've not had an analysis of that. And we've not had an analysis of the strange shaped hexagon pattern. It looks like rubber. That's not been analysed. And then if you go beyond that and you start looking at the other fragments, the tin foil, the foil bit hasn't been analysed either. So the only bits we've really got analysis for is the metal itself, because that is relatively straightforward to do that. Other than that, folks are guessing. You know, they're guessing at what the rest of the material might be.
Which also begs the question, obviously, because this was clearly, if it was duralumin, then at that particular point in time, that was, you know, we're not talking a few pounds here. We're talking thousands and thousands of pounds worth of stuff that was left scattered all over this farm.
Do you want to really get in there? This is a rabbit hole well worth going down. I'll go to the analysis. This is where this whole aspect gets really exciting. I have to say, duralumin, by the way, is like a trade name. So it's a bit like, you know, Coca-Cola or McDonald's or, you know, whatever. It's a trade name generally for aluminium alloys. So there's a huge variety of them. You know, it's a whole series of these aluminium alloys. So the first analysis comes back, and it comes back, let's call it that's the UK analysis. Let's call this one the Australia. The Australian analysis comes back. And the first thing it says in the analysis is, well, it's not duralumin. So, well, oh, okay, what do you mean it's not duralumin? So you go through the analysis. It's aluminium foam. Now, apparently what you can do is you can mix aluminium with certain other substances and it foams. It turns into a foam, which obviously is lightweight. And then at room temperature, it hardens. So you finish up with this quite revolutionary foaming aluminium metal. But what the hell's that doing in a farmer's field in 1983?
Yes.
Because it didn't exist. It didn't exist, because whatever was flying would have had to, it logically would have had to have been developed in the late 1970s, going over into the early 1980s. It takes years of trials to get anything to fly. So if they chuck something up in the sky made of aluminium foam and it was still there, let's be generous. Let's say, you know, 3 or 4 years to develop it. That means they had this in 1979. Now, that's impossible. From a logical, straightforward, technological point of view, nobody had that. Now, the other thing with the Australian thing is they came back and they went, yeah, we know what this is. No problem at all. It's covered with this particular type of American glue. I quote the number in the report that they gave for it. This particular type of American glue, and there's nothing exotic about this at all. That's what it is, aluminium foam. Well, of course it's exotic. And then we get the one back from America. Their analysis comes back. You open the front page of the analysis. Big letters. Unknown. We don't know what the hell this is. Unknown. We can tell you what it's made of, but we don't know what it is. It's a certain type of metal. Lanthium, or lanthanum, as it's known. That's what it is. It's an alloy of lanthium. At which point my head just goes, you know, everybody's head's going to go, okay, what the hell are they talking about? So anyway, I dug into this a bit deeper. It's not rare. It's not a rare metal, okay? So it's somewhere like number 27 in the list of most common things found on Earth, you know. So it's out there with chalk, you know, mud, bits of volcanic basalt. You know, it's kind of, it's not a particular, it's called an exotic metal.
Yes.
An exotic substance because it is flipping hard to isolate.
Mm.
It's really, really difficult to isolate. Now, as a side issue to that, it's also in comets, asteroids, outer space, other galaxies, and the upper atmosphere. So it's everywhere. It's all over the place. It would cost to produce this alloy of lanthium tens of thousands of pounds, if not millions of pounds, to produce it. Now, what we have established is the sample that went to Australia is the thin metal with the green paint and the grey resin. And the sample that went to USA, we assumed was the same metal because it's the same colour. And that's the one that's got grey resin on it, but it's got this green rubbery hexagonal material on, which is the material that Irwell saw in sheets of 6 feet and bigger. So two metre sheets of this. And it's covering four fields. That's tens of millions of pounds worth of a metal that we can only just produce now under duress. So now you've got, this is the smoking gun, because you've got a substance that shouldn't exist that has been misidentified, you know, and possibly tried to be covered up by at least two labs. Then the Americans, bless them, come through and go, hey, this is not one of ours. This is what it really is. You start looking at that and you think this is off the Richter scale. It only leaves you with two alternatives. Either number one, it's a kind of super technology, which if it's the same as what crashed at Roswell, you know, 60, 70 years ago, of course they could have developed that from there, you know, if it's one of ours, or even since the Second World War, you're looking at 90 odd years since then. Or it's alien technology and it's been back engineered, in which case it's not one of ours. And it's got enough scope for it to be not one of ours. There's the smoking gun. That's what most people are looking for. The lanthanum, the lanthium, is one of these impossible metals. So if you've got a key ring out there and you've got one of these little bits of fragments in there with, you know, the green hexagon rubbery stuff on it, that's what you've got. You've got lanthanum, and it's 90-odd percent lanthium.
Mm.
It's just bonkers. What I came up with, because, again, I don't think it's in the book. What I tried to do in the book, by the way, was not speculate.
Yeah.
So I do come up with a couple of these bullet points, but, you know, I want people to think about it. I want people to analyse it themselves and come up with their own kind of suggestions. But what I was thinking is the lanthium, the lanthanum, is the outer shell. So now that's on the outside. That's quite safe to be on the outside of a vehicle, and it can be aerodynamic. And the little hexagons, the rubbery stuff, might prove to be like a giant printed circuit, you know, because it does carry electricity. It's conductive. But those bits then are attached to the hexagonal foil. So the foil is the internal structure. That's what gives it its strength. And it gives it its substance. So the foil could be, you know, an inch, 2 inch, 3 inches thick. The inside is the aluminium foam. That's the inside shell. Again, with the resin facing the hexagon aluminium foil, but the paint, the green paint, is on the inside, not on the outside, which is why it's not aerodynamic. So what I've described to you there is a form of sandwich, if you like, to produce an incredibly lightweight, phenomenally hard, ultra sophisticated shell. And that, I think what I've just described to you now is super technology. That's what it is. It's some kind of super technology. And I'm afraid, like I said, when we did the analysis, we fell down the rabbit hole because there's no way of knowing whether it's us or them.
Well, I know Gary refers to the fact that he tried to, did he say he tried to stand on it to crush it and it just wouldn't?
Yeah, he got a piece of this lanthium. He's got quite a big piece of it. It's about sort of 12 inches long by about 10 inches wide. And most of it's, well, depending on which way around you look at it, it's either concave or convex. But either way, it's curved. So he put this on the floor, you know, with the bend going upwards and stamped on the bend. And it just doesn't give, you know, it just goes boom and pops straight back. You know, it hasn't got the give in it. It's really, really strong. And then also he discovered with the other stuff, which is presumably it's the aluminium foam, because he tried to get bits off that. He snapped bits off that for samples. We got part of it. Anyway, he's trying to get samples off. If you really go at it, you know, if you attack it with full force, it doesn't give. It just seems to push back. But then if you slow right back and take it nice and easy and just get hold of it with a set of pliers and just waggle it slowly, then eventually it fractures and it comes off. So I think that's a clue to how the crash actually occurred. I think this, whatever it is, this shell was designed to, you know, travel at high speed, high pressure, possibly inside some kind of a force field, you know, whatever, is zipping through, you know, time and space, fab. It works dead well. But if you get it to slow down and then it gets attacked by trees, so in other words, it's like an eggshell. It's getting battered at very low speed and by something that's actually hitting it at low frequency, then it shatters. You know, I think it's designed to be in a pressure situation, pressurized in some way. Gary went even further. He said it looked like something had exploded inside, you know, as if it had hit the trees, gone wrong, and then exploded over the fields, scattering the debris. So that shape could be because it was blown out, you know, and it bent in the explosion. But I'm in favor of it being some kind of high pressure shell that gives when it's at low pressure, when you apply low pressure to it. It's incredible stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's almost as if kinetic force makes it stronger, which is remarkable. Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Because as you explained there, Mark, you would think if you go at it hammer and tongs, so that's going to be far easier than sitting there and patiently just picking a bit off it, which shows you that clearly, whatever it was, it's designed to withstand velocity of some description.
Yeah, whatever you put into it, it pushes back.
Yeah. Mind-boggling.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at what point did Gary's investigation fizzle out then? Was it once he got all the reports back? Did he get stonewalled? Did he not seem to pick people up? Because looking at this and the evidence and the story and the newspaper article and the witness, there are lesser well-documented cases that seem to be far more well-known, Mark, than this.
Yeah.
Did it just fizzle out? Did he move on to something else? It's peculiar for me that, as we've said, 1983... Nobody seems to know much about it. And then 25 years later, you've got involved and done your documentary.
No, it's not. It doesn't quite go like that. Clearly, it took quite a bit of time in the early 1980s to wade through the pea soup that was surrounding this. And obviously, being part of the UFO community and a public speaker and doing a lot of other things as well, Gary was extremely busy. He is an absolute mine of information about UFOs, some of his personal material, encounters, interviews, things he's seen and done would, you know, fill volumes. He's an amazing bloke when it comes to UFOs in Wales. So what basically happened is somewhere by the beginning of the 1990s, the case wasn't moving. And as far as Gary was concerned, it's just another case. Yeah, it's a brilliant case. It's a very good case, you know, but it clearly wasn't progressing any further. When I met him, you know, early 2000s, he was still very keen, you know, to do something with it. But the way he sort of couched it to me was he said, you know, he doesn't want anything sensational. He just wants something low key. He said he almost wants it doing as like a student production, a student film. So we're not sucking in lots of people with lots of interests. And sure enough, I did it with my own production company, Mythco. I did it with my own team and we did it low key. We did it on the fly. And then when it came out through Reality Films in America. Reality Films released it. So if you really wanted, to go and see it, you know, it was on Amazon Prime. You know, it was on for free and then it went to pay to view. So as a documentary, the documentary itself was within itself incredibly successful. But when the DVD release came out, I was only contacted by one radio station from the States, and they never followed it up for an interview. So you're back to this situation where it was like it was being silenced again, stonewalled. So it kind of bloomed again, it blossomed again between 2005 and 2008 when it came out. That was the 25-year anniversary. And then coming back to it now, revisiting it again now, we've pushed harder again. You know, we've gone to Freedom of Information. We've trawled the net. We've looked at everything Gary's said and done since. And I cheated a bit with that because I did it without telling Gary I was going to do it. So I went and checked all his interviews. Yeah. I checked anything else that he'd done because I thought I'll do it independently. And do you know what? His story is the same every time. Give or take a few details. Bob on. Absolutely bang on. You know, totally believable. So I've got no qualms at all with the material. I can vouch for that. Gary's right on the ball. And then, you know, we did the analysis. We rechecked it. And the book is what it is. You know, if you sat on your porch while the sun's going down with a large, you know, whiskey and Coke and you fancy killing 2 or 3 hours and something that's a real head scratcher, you know, it's not War and Peace. It'll never be War and Peace. But we're not trying to pack it out. You know, there's no baggage.
Yeah.
From my point of view, I wanted to put on written record basically what we filmed. So it follows the documentary pretty closely in its content and in its format. But there is quite a lot of additional material. You know, there's loads of extra stuff in there that people have never seen before. There's 5 appendix at the end and they're all full of new stuff, you know. It's just... It's kind of just tumbled and burbled and bubbled along. And, you know, the right people at the right time have always been involved with it. And Philip Mantle at Flying Disc Press, I mean, I couldn't have a better publisher for this than Philip. You know, he is world renowned as an expert in ufology. You know, he's the best of the best with honours. And he's been on the ball with this, right, you know, all the way along. Clearly, Gary feels the same way as well. If anyone's got to lose anything, it's Gary, you know, I mean, he doesn't want masses of people swarming down on him or to lose his career, or you know, he doesn't even want to lose the pieces of metal. He wants to keep them. So,
yeah,
you know, but none of us are getting any younger. So here it is. You know, we're presenting it to the world as it really is. This is it. Europe's Roswell, 40 years since Impact. But no, it's not. It's not gone quiet. It's always been there. But like you say, it just keeps popping up as, you know, a passing comment in things that other people have done, you know.
Well, I think it speaks volumes for Gary, because I'm aware of another case from the UK where someone involved in it claims to have something that they say proves what happened. The only problem with that is what they now display doesn't bear resemblance to what they were showing 25 years ago. They're not the same objects, Mark. And I'll not say any more about that. But
okay,
that, for me, speaks volumes about Gary's honesty here, because especially, and I mean this with the greatest of respect to everybody involved in the field, there have been numerous individuals over the years that have made wild and extraordinary claims in the field of ufology and claim to have all sorts of evidence. it would have been easier for Gary to do that than it would be to have dealt with this in the professional and well-documented manner that he did.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And his timing as well. I mean, I did speak to Gary about doing the book and what have you, and we discussed this, the fact now that we are, how can I put it, we're teetering on the verge of some kind of disclosure. It's not here yet. It's not come yet. You know, nobody's told us anything we didn't already know yet. But the atmosphere is different. So I've said in a couple of press releases and things I put out, this book is not disclosure, but it's scratching at the door of disclosure, if you know what I mean. We're clearly sending a message now to people in authority or whatever and saying, look, we've got bits of one of these now. It's not open to debate. You know, it's not marsh gas. It's not weather balloons. You know, it's not, you know, the moon eclipse or whatever. This is something else. This physically exists. We've physically got it. It's out. The cat's out of the bag. You're not going to put the cat back in. So we are literally, literally scratching at the door of disclosure going, you know, come on, tell us, you beggars. You know, the timing's perfect. You know, so hats off to Gary, like you say. Hats off to Gary for keeping his nerve.
Absolutely. He's certainly played a good hand.
He has.
I think... all in all, it's a deeply intriguing case, but there's one aspect of the book that we've never spoken before. Obviously, as we said at the beginning, Mark, this is your third appearance. We've spoken about your previous two ones. You, as a young man, had several experiences, but you had one in particular that clearly affected you a great deal. I'm always intrigued because when I had my sighting of something I have never claimed... it was a UFO. Well, it was a UFO. I don't know what it was, but I know what it wasn't.
Yes.
What I saw bears very little resemblance to traditional sightings. I saw a giant ball of fire. If anything, I think I've seen an extremely rare meteorological event, Mark.
Yes, yes. That would be my first reaction. Yeah.
Very similar to, I think it was Saturday night. I went outside on my balcony. The dog needed a toilet break. I walked out, beautiful clear sky, and we've got this incredible halo around the moon that everybody up and down the country is taking wonderful pictures of.
Yeah.
And such is my love of weirdness, I thought, I wonder if that's a moon version of a sun dog. And it is.
It is,
But they call it a moon halo. I was a bit disappointed it wasn't called a moon dog. But, and I just thought, that's beautiful. It's stunning. And but it was so... prime example. It was so beautiful. I thought, shall I take a picture of that? And I thought, nah, it'll probably look crap. unfortunately, lots of other people have taken pictures of it. And clearly, if I'd have taken the time, it would have looked all right. But I think when I read your incident, or the one, because as you said, you obviously, when you go out at night or you're taking a break or chilling out, I always look at the sky because I love space and the stars and I just find it very therapeutic. You know, I'm one of those people, I'll chuckle to myself when I see a strange looking cloud. I'll go, oh, that looks like Scooby-Doo or something strange, you know, and just chuckle to myself, Mark. I'm very easily entertained. And so I've always continued, especially I always used to look to the sky before I saw something. I look even closer now since it happened, which was, what, 13 years ago now, 2010. Mm. For you, I'm really impressed with the fact that you had such a sighting that sort of made a real impact on you to then suddenly realise down the line you weren't the only person that saw that night. How did that make you feel after all those years?
Wow. That's a good question. When I first saw what I thought was my sighting on the front cover of Mysteries of the Mersey Valley by Jenny Randall, when I first saw that, that was a eureka moment. You know what I mean? That was a, oh, look at that. I'm not on my own. I wonder if that's the same one, you know, that kind of response. But I mean, I live here. This is my, you know, backyard. You know, this is my local area. So with an interest such as I have in things unusual, I thought, hey, well, it can't not be. There's not been anything else like that up here, you know, for that not to be this. But the story begins. I mean, it begins in 1981, you know, it begins before that because I'd already seen like unidentified flying star in the 1970s, 1976. So I knew things were up there. I also watched Close Encounters in 1977, like everybody did, and, you know, et cetera. So there was a lot of interest at that time in UFOs. And I finished up in the music business and finished a session in a studio up here. Liverpool, Manchester, loads of studios. It was a Liverpool studio I came out of in the early hours. And there's a big hill. There's a massive hill at the back of where I live. And you can go up on top of the hill and you can see the whole of the Mersey Valley from like Manchester to Liverpool. And It's 1981. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm up on the hill, winding down. It's been a long day. It's been whatever, 12, 13, 14 hour session. And what I see is, I'm looking off to the left. We have this big thing here called Fiddler's Ferry Power Station, coal powered. Coincidentally, they're demolishing it on Sunday. so the cooling towers I'm about to talk about are about to be demolished, but I'm looking down at this thing, and the first four cooling towers of the eight, which are closest to the River Mersey, I see coming through the steam is a collection of lights, and they're lighting up the steam. And my first reaction is, oh, it's a helicopter. And then my second reaction is, hang on a minute, that steam's the same temperature as a kettle. So you're talking about, like, you know, 40, 50 degrees. You don't fly a helicopter across the top of a cooling tower.
No.
Like that. You know, you just, you're asking for trouble. Anyway, it breaks through the smoke. And it's like the little scout ships in Close Encounters, where you've got these lights that are scanning the ground. They're very clear spotlights, but within the light itself, they change color. So they might be white, and then they'll suddenly change to blue, and then they'll change to red, you know, and then change to white. And they're constantly scanning. And it just comes up the north bank of the River Mersey. It's kind of sailing at a nice slow speed in a straight line. And I'm watching this thing with the lights going, and I'm like, there's no sound either. That's not a helicopter. So it gets to roughly where sort of the town centre is. So behind it, you can see the town lights. You know, it's light pollution all over the place. And it gets sort of just short of the bridge at bridge foot. And then all the lights go off. All at once, in an instant, and you just for a second, split second, you can see this outline about the size of a 7.5-ton truck, and it's just a blob. You can see this blob. But then again, in a split second, this blob shoots vertically up into the sky and disappears. I'm like, what the hell's that? Now, it made sufficient impression on me to write that down in a journal. So I got the date. 12th of July, 1981, I wrote down, round about 2:30 in the morning. Okay, this is where the story gets really interesting, because you fast forward 11 years and that's when I find this book. So I've had no contact with anybody else about this, and I find this book, this Mysteries of Mid-Mersey Valley, Mysteries of Mersey Valley. So I'm reading it, and somebody spotted this thing from an aeroplane. They're coming into Liverpool Airport. They can see this strange light, you know, looks like they described it as looking down on a light bulb from above, and it's hovering over an industrial estate on the Wirral. And they come into the airport, and they report seeing it, but they don't make an official report, but it's noted. But at the same time, there's some people camping on the Wirral, and they can see it sideways. They can see this thing sideways up, and all of a sudden it changes. It turns from this light bulb color to this thing with all these different colored lights on, and comes whizzing towards them. So it flies over the top of them, disappears down the River Mersey, and lo and behold, vanishes through the smoke on the power station. At which point, of course, I see it, because it comes whizzing through on my side. Now, when you join all the accounts together, the timeline is perfect. It's like, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, five minutes of early morning time. The sequence is perfect as well, one to another, to another, to another. And it's a perfectly straight line. It's about 14 miles from where the incident begins to when it hits Warrington and then disappears in a dead straight line. So it's clearly, it's the same thing. Now, the other interesting thing is that I was asked to give this account for a book that a friend of Philip's was doing. I'm trying to remember what the name of the book was. Oh, it's Jason Gleaves. Jason Gleaves did this Encounters Up Close and Personal.
Yes.
I put some really nice illustrations in there as well. So he asked me to put this story together. So then you're talking 39 years later, and I finally write this thing up. I write the encounter up for him. So I thought, do you know what? I'm going to put it in the book. It has to go in the book. Because I do talk about it in the documentary in 2009. I do give my couple of stories there. And then, of course, subsequent to that, you know, once I get into archaeology and all that, you know, and when you're out and about, you do see things up in the sky. And very occasionally, so do the people with you who are digging. I'll give you one that's not in the book, actually. This is a nice illustration. I'm minding my own business, and we're just doing a dig up in Buxton. And I'm sat there with my cup of tea in the kitchen of this big house where we're digging. And one of the diggers comes running in, and she's like, you're not going to believe this. We've just been buzzed by a UFO. I'm like, what do you mean? She said, well, there's about half a dozen of us out there. We're camping. And she said, this big disc flew over the top of us. And this is in Derbyshire. So it flew over the top of us and disappeared off at high speed. And I'm like, oh, drat, I missed it. But stuff like that happens all the time. You know, some of these things, you know, like the 70s and 80s encounters, there weren't even satellites.
Yeah.
You know, there was nothing up there that would create this sort of effect, you know. So, yeah, that's really where my interest comes from, before Gary really even, you know, contacted me. I've seen these things. So I kind of, you file it away and you go, yeah, they're definitely up there. I know they're out there, you know. Mm. But yeah, that's how I got involved. That's my own encounter.
Yeah. Yeah. Fabulous. I suppose it's quite reassuring to have it validated, because I've never seen anybody report what I saw. I mean, I don't understand how nobody saw it, Mark, other than me. Or maybe people just thought it was something else. Like I said to you earlier, I know exactly what it wasn't, and especially where I live. You know, where we live, we're under a flight path. There's planes flying over Sheffield all the time. We've got Chinese lanterns left, right and centre. We've got helicopters.
Yeah.
Drones.
Yeah. Well, the triangles turn out to be drones, didn't they? The things that have been seen over Winter Hill.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I knew what it wasn't. I knew it wasn't a reflection or whatever. And I know for a fact it was a ball of fire.
It was a weather balloon. Go on, it was a weather balloon.
A weather balloon on fire, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I watched it for like 40 minutes. It wasn't like a brief sighting. So yeah. I'm still perplexed. I still think about it often. But this is one of those things that since then, and obviously as we've all developed with smartphone technology and things, I've now got flight trackers and things on my phone. Primarily because sometimes, you know, as I was saying, I'm easily entertained. Even clowns make me laugh, Mark. So... there'll be times when I'll see a plane, I'll think, oh, I wonder where that's going. I'll check my flight tracker. But, oh, blimey, that's interesting. Whatever. So I'm always ready to validate. If I see something in the sky outside on a night when I'm with the dog or whatever, I'll always go, right, I wonder if that's that. Oh, yeah, it's just that. It's just a plane. Yeah. You can tell a drone from a mile away as well. Especially, around here. We had some, I don't know, about 3 or 4 months ago flying around at 11 o'clock at night. As soon as you saw it, you were like, oh, what's that? That's a bit weird. And the more you watched it, the more obvious it became. It was clearly a drone the way it was flying. And then you could really just hear the noise of the rotors.
Yeah.
So I think when you have validation to what you saw from other angles at the same time, it just, I suppose it gives you a sense of satisfaction and it gives you a bit of relief, really, that you weren't the only person that particular night. You were.
Yeah, I'd have never have thought of actually, you know, putting that story in writing if I'd not had extra evidence, you know.
Yeah.
It's going back to that validation, isn't it, really? Mm. And for it to take 11 years for me to actually find out that anybody else even noticed it, and then, you know, 32 years for me to get around to actually writing it up. You know, it's been a long time coming, that one. So, I'm quite happy. I'm happy it's gone into print at last.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did as well. It was a very interesting encounter. So, I mean, you've had an extremely prolific 18 months, Mark.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you need to pull your socks up for next year, because I don't, what's happening next?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what, let's do it as a running piece. Let's get all the adverts out of the way. I hate doing the adverts, so let's get rid of those. Running up to last Christmas was Crystal Skulls and Human Heads. Coming into this year in the spring was King Arthur, which had took 45 years to get that book into print. And that has definitely set some waves out on the pond. But that's a history archaeology book, but it's written for everybody. And then now, of course, you've got Europe's Roswell. That came out the 1st of November. So as you say, it's been a busy year. Anybody that wants to go and buy anything of mine, there's 9 books in all. They're all on Amazon. Dead easy. Just go onto Amazon, pick the book, pay for it, click. 3 days later, comes whizzing through your door. Love it. So, that's sort of pretty well done. Then for about the last sort of 8 or 9 months, we've been trying to get my back catalogue of stuff into a position where people can see it, especially Lost Treasures. I mean, Lost Treasures was 2005, 2007, 2008. So the first series is 18 years old. So I teamed up with a company called Drake Michigan, all one word. and they've put the whole lot on YouTube. So there's 22 episodes, six extras that folks won't have seen to do with Lost Treasures. Probably about half a dozen documentaries have gone up now, and there's another one going up in December. At least half of those people won't have seen. One of them's brand new. The one that went up this month was Disappearing Ninth Legion. We finished it in 2019, but lockdown sort of killed that off as a release, but now it's out there. Personally think it's one of the best things we've ever done. So people need to go and check that out. Shed loads of interviews. I can't tell you how many interviews there are out there. You just go and have a look. Google, see what you find. What's coming up? Well, we're still working with bands. I mean, I managed to put an album out in April, May with a band called Copperworm, which is now doing other things, but that's another story. And I'm still working with my high school band, Wolf. We're planning a major summer concert in the Tower Brewery, Burton-on-Trent. We're looking at June. I think somebody suggested the Friday the 5th of June next year. We'd like that to be a lockout. What's not to like? You know, heavy metal band in a heavy rock band, 1970s vintage style in a brewery. You know, we're on stage with all the brewing vats around us. You know, it's going to be a real party. It only holds about 150 people, though, so that's going to be a good one.
Yeah.
Hopefully they'll be hanging out the doors and the windows. You know, that's where we're going with that one. I've started on the next two books. I've not been sure really which ones to pursue, but there's one on the basics of working magic, which I think is worth doing, because I've got lots of experience in the magical realm. So let's get some of that out there. So we're not talking about, I'll say it how it is, we're not talking about nonsense. We're talking about stuff that actually works and why. So that's going to be an interesting book to do. And at the same time as that, I'm working, that's only going to be a small one. And then I'm working on another monster book, which is threatening to be the same size as the King Arthur one. And that's all about the early biblical pre-Constantine the Great material. And it's dismantling the sort of biblical stuff. The working title is The Keys to the Temple. And it's literally everything to do with temple. So you've got Old Testament, New Testament. And then it goes on into the Templars, the Gnostics, you know, and all that side of things. And it's using source material. So it just annoys me. There's so much twaddle that's made up, you know, stuff that's only been invented in the last, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. And people just quote other people all the time. And I'm like, it's time for a source book.
Yes.
So hopefully I'm going to put some dynamite under some folks in the next 12 months. And not that I would do that, you know what I mean? Yes. It's not like that's not what I do anyway, you know. So there's some good stuff coming.
Brilliant.
And they're in progress as well. I'm actually writing them, so I'm not just thinking ahead, you know. And then goodness knows what's going to happen next year. I mean, I'm doing a few UFO conferences. I'm planning to go on tour again in the autumn because I usually do that. I've not really toured properly since lockdown, so I think it's time to string all the venues together and go on the road again.
Mm.
I've been invited to do something in America as well, possibly in the spring, so I don't know whether that's going to come off or not. So it's looking fairly exciting. So, you know, as long as I can still breathe, I'll be doing stuff. Anybody wants to contact me, Facebook, dead easy. Just come and friend me. You know, we can have a chat on Messenger. There you go. Go on, back to you again.
No problem. Well, Mark, thank you as always. It's always a pleasure spending time in your company, having a chewing over the fat of your books, finding out where we're taking you. Like I said, the three books you've released are all in the last few months are all very different. All fascinating. I have to say that, as we said at the time, the King Arthur book was remarkable.
Yeah.
For somebody as new to it and the whole permutations that exist in regards to who's what and where and why and how, it was fascinating. So I'm always interested and intrigued by how you cast your eye over any subject. So I look forward to whatever you've got coming down the pipeline. And I just want to say thank you as always for your time and your conversation. And I hope you and yours have a very Merry Christmas.
And the same to you and yours and your listeners also. Yeah, it's always a pleasure to be here.